Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, March 27, 2017, during a live Courthouse Steps teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's teleforum conference call, as today we discuss the very important issue of venue in IP cases. In particular, a case argued this morning in the U.S. Supreme Court, T.C. Heartland versus Kraft Foods. This is a Courthouse Steps edition of Teleforum. We're covering a case that was argued today. Normally, our expert would either have been reviewing the transcript or attended oral argument this morning. Unfortunately, the transcript has not yet been released for that case. So our plan here is to just go over some background on the case, the facts of the case, the law of the case, and the briefs in the case. Without, unfortunately, getting to what transpired at oral argument. I am, by the way, Dean Reuter, Vice President, Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. And please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. I'm very pleased to welcome Professor J. Devlin Hartline. He's the Assistant Director of the Center for the Protection of Intellectual Property and an adjunct professor at the Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University. That's where CPIP, the Center for Protection of Intellectual Property, is also housed. With that, the floor is he's going to give us opening remarks, I should say, of about 20 minutes. But as always, we'll be looking to you for questions. And if anybody in the audience attended oral argument, we'd be happy to hear from you as well. But 20 minutes of opening remarks. Professor, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean. I appreciate it. And thanks to the Federalist Society for having me on today to discuss T.C. Heartland v. Kraft Foods, a seemingly boring case about procedural law and patent cases that many people are closely watching. What makes the case so interesting is that the Supreme Court's decision could affect not only where practicing entities like Kraft Foods can sue for patent infringement, but also where non-practicing entities, the so-called patent trolls, can sue alleged infringers. Despite the fact that neither party to this case is by any means a patent troll, commentators quickly noticed that its resolution could keep many trolls out of the Eastern District of Texas, a supposed hotbed of troll activity. Indeed, many amicus briefs have been filed pointing out the broader policy implications of the case. And of course, there have been recent legislative attempts to rewrite the venue rules for patent owners. Assuming the Supreme Court declines to change the rules in this case, it's pretty safe to assume that Congress will once again propose such changes. While this case has interesting headline-grabbing ramifications for patent trolls, it is at heart a somewhat boring matter of statutory interpretation and the history of procedural law. My discussion will focus primarily on the legal issues in the case. I'll start with a brief explanation of how we got to where we are today, and then I'll turn to the party's specific arguments before the Supreme Court. On January 14, 2014, Kraft Foods sued T.C. Heartland in the District of Delaware for patent infringement. Heartland sold drink enhancers, concentrated liquids used to flavor drinking water, under the Refresh brand, among others. Kraft alleged that the containers used by Heartland to dispense these drink enhancers infringed three of its patents. Kraft is incorporated in Delaware with its principal place of business in Illinois. Heartland is incorporated in Indiana with its principal place of business in Indiana. Kraft argued that venue is proper in the District of Delaware pursuant to 28 U.S.C. 1391C, the general venue statute, and 28 U.S.C. 1400B, the patent venue statute. These two venue statutes are at the heart of this case. Traditionally, venue rules protect defendants from the inconvenience of traveling to remote destinations, far from the residence or the locality where the underlying acts took place. The general venue rules, which dictate the appropriate district courts in which an action may be brought, are found in Section 1391. 1391B includes substantive venue provisions, which establish venue in most federal civil suits. 1391C, by contrast, defines the residency of defendant, quote, for all venue purposes. At issue here is whether 1391C2, which provides that a juridical entity, such as a corporation, shall be deemed to reside in any judicial district in which such defendant is subject to the court's personal jurisdiction. Importantly, Section 1391(c)(2) is not a substantive venue statute. That is, it does not establish venue. Instead, 1391(c)(2) merely defines where a corporate defendant resides, and that definition is then applied to substantive venue provisions like the ones found in 1391(b). The question in this case is whether the residency definition in 1391(c)(2) applies to 1400(b), the substantive venue statute for patent infringement suits. 1400(b) provides, any civil action for patent infringement may be brought in the judicial district where the defendant resides. If the residency definition in 1391(c)(2) applies to 1400(b), then patent owners can sue for infringement wherever a district court has personal jurisdiction over a corporate defendant, potentially in every judicial district for nationwide enterprises. In June of 2014, Heartland filed a motion to dismiss in the district court and asked for a change of venue from the District of Delaware to the Southern District of Indiana. Heartland argued that not only did it have no offices in Delaware, only 2% of its products were shipped into that state. Furthermore, Heartland argued that resides in 1400(b) refers only to the state of incorporation, and it is not to be supplemented by the residency definition in 1391(c)(2). More than a year later, in September of 2015, the district judge denied Heartland's motion to transfer. The district court held that 1391(c) does apply to 1400(b) and that venue is appropriate for a defendant in a patent infringement case where personal jurisdiction exists. Heartland then turned to the Federal Circuit in October of 2015 for a writ of mandamus, ordering the district court to either dismiss or transfer the case. Heartland again argued that it does not reside in Delaware under 1400(b). Numerous amicus briefs were filed in the Federal Circuit supporting both Heartland and Kraft. In April of 2016, the Federal Circuit denied Heartland's petition for a writ of mandamus, at one point stating that Heartland's venue arguments were, quote, utterly without merit or logic. The Federal Circuit reasoned that 1391(c), quote, expressly reads itself into the specific statute 1400(b) and that it only operates to define a term in 1400(b). Having lost at both the District Court and the Federal Circuit, Heartland next turned to the Supreme Court in September of 2016 for a writ of certiorari. Numerous amicus briefs were again filed supporting both parties. Despite the somewhat strange procedural posture of the case, a denied writ of mandamus on a denied motion to dismiss or transfer, the Supreme Court granted cert in December of 2016. Turning to the brief for the petitioner, Heartland, Heartland's primary argument focuses on the Supreme Court's 1957 opinion in Forco Glass, where the court explicitly held that the patent venue provision in 1400(b) is not to be supplemented by the provisions of 1391(c). Indeed, the text of 1400(b) has not changed since Congress enacted it in 1948, and the patent venue statutes dating back to 1897 say essentially the same thing. Moreover, even before Forco, the Supreme Court had reached a similar conclusion interpreting Section 48 of the Judicial Code, the predecessor to 1400(b), which provided that a patent owner could sue for infringement where the defendant was, quote, an inhabitant. In its 1942 opinion in Stonite Products, the court held that Section 48 is the exclusive provision controlling venue in patent infringement proceedings. Heartland argues that the Supreme Court has already addressed the very issue in this case, namely that the general venue rules do not supplement the specific patent venue rules. However, the monkey wrench in the modern doctrine traces back to the Federal Circuit's 1990 opinion in V.E. Holding, where the appellate court held that the 1988 amendments to Section 1391(c) legislatively overruled Forco. In 1988, Section 1391(c) was changed from a substantive venue statute, which actually established venue for a corporate defendant, to merely a definitional statute defining where a corporation resides, quote, for purposes of venue under this chapter. The Federal Circuit in B.E. Holding found that this alteration in 1391C radically changed the law. Quote, "We hold that Congress, by its 1988 amendment of Section 1391C, meant what it said. The meaning of the term resides in 1400B has changed." The Federal Circuit acknowledged that the same question was presented in Forco, but it found that the reasoning of Forco no longer applied. Whereas the version of 1391C at issue in Forco conflicted with 1400B in that both statutes established venue, the Federal Circuit held that the amended version of 1391C no longer conflicted with 1400B, since the former no longer established venue. And the fact that 1391C expressly applied, quote, "for purposes of venue under this chapter," referring to Chapter 87 of Title 28, which included 1400B, sealed the deal. Heartland argues that V.E. Holding was wrongly decided and that Forco remains the law of the land. It points to the principle that Congress, quote, "does not hide elephants in mouse holes," and says that V.E. Holding, quote, "somehow found a huge elephant, indeed a revolution in patent venue, overturning more than 90 years of stable law, lurking in the smallest of mouse holes, an enactment that was not amending the patent venue statute." Heartland notes that V.E. Holding's understanding of resides conflicts with Section 1694, which authorizes service of process in a patent infringement action in a district where the defendant is not a resident but has a regular and established place of business. Under V.E. Holding, there could be no district where a defendant has a regular and established place of business but is not also a resident. Likewise, Heartland argues that the second half of Section 1400B is rendered superfluous for corporate defendants, since a corporate defendant will have a regular and established place of business wherever it resides. Heartland submits that the Federal Circuit's broad read of the patent venue rules, quote, "has rendered patent plaintiffs uniquely able to file suit in districts chosen for their geographical remoteness from a defendant and for local norms and practices that tend to favor patent plaintiffs in various ways." It argues that the Federal Circuit's revisionist interpretation of Section 1400B has led to, quote, "serious abuses of forum shopping," despite Congress's intent to prevent such abuses of nationwide venue and patent infringement litigation. Finally, Heartland contends that the 2011 amendments to Section 1391C repealed the very statutory language, quote, "for purposes of venue under this chapter," upon which V.E. Holding rested. Moreover, the 2011 revision added a new subsection indicating that it applies, quote, "except as otherwise provided by law," which Heartland contends includes the Supreme Court's precedent in Forco. According to Heartland, since the Federal Circuit is an inferior appellate court, its holding in V.E. Holding was not settled law when 1391C was revamped in 2011. Turning to the brief for the respondent, Kraft responds that the question presented is answered by the 2011 amendments to 1391C. It argues that Congress did not intend, as Heartland suggests, to define residency, quote, "for all venue purposes except patent venue purposes." Kraft contends that because Section 1391C's definitions of residence apply for all venue purposes, those definitions supply the meaning of the term resides as used in Section 1400B. Quote, "it really is that simple." Kraft points to the history of the 2011 amendments, which emerged from a years-long reform project spearheaded by the American Law Institute, or ALI. According to ALI, it recommended, quote, "sweeping revisions to 1391C in order to provide uniform definitions of residence that would apply to venue statutes throughout the U.S. Code. Rather than undertake the, quote, "challenging, delicate, and indeed agonizing process of amending individual venue statutes," ALI suggested that the venue rules could be clarified by simply amending 1391C. ALI noted that special venue statutes would not be displaced, as indicated by the prefatory phrase, quote, "except as otherwise provided by law." However, ALI explained that the residency definition would apply globally to all venue statutes, whether of general or special applicability. Turning to Heartland's argument that 1400B is not to be supplemented by 1391C, Kraft contends that this creates a loophole for foreign defendants. 1391C3 provides, quote, a defendant not resident in the United States may be sued in any judicial district. But if 1391C does not apply in patent infringement cases, as Heartland contends, then no venue would lie for many foreign defendants. To Heartland's argument that Kraft's interpretation of resides renders the second half of 1400B superfluous, Kraft responds that the clause provides a basis for venue in suits against individual defendants who are domiciled in only one district. Moreover, Kraft notes that such redundancies are not unusual where, as here, Congress decided to adopt a generally applicable definition of residence rather than parse through and harmonize hundreds of special venue statutes, and it points to other venue statutes with similar redundancies. Likewise, Kraft argues that the inconsistency with Section 1694 concerning service of process is simply the result of legislation that overhauled venue rules without touching service of process statutes. There was no need to change Section 1694, Kraft continues, because the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure already supply a means for service of process in a patent infringement case. And to the continued applicability of FORCO, Kraft argues that the result was driven by the legislative history of the 1948 recodification of Title 28, which showed that Congress intended 1400B to operate the same as it had under the predecessor version that was analyzed in Stonite. By contrast, Kraft contends that the 1988 and 2011 amendments to 1391C evince Congress's unambiguous purpose to define residency broadly for all litigants, and nothing suggests they should be disregarded as non-substantive. Turning to VE Holding, Kraft suggests that it is irrelevant whether the Federal Circuit correctly interpreted 1391C under the 1988 amendments. The only thing that matters here, Kraft continues, is whether 1391C under the 2011 amendments unambiguously provides the meaning of resides in Section 1400B. Kraft argues that the 2011 amendments to the venue rules, including 1391C, were not elephants hiding in mouse holes, since they were widely regarded as enacting far-reaching changes. Kraft rejects the suggestion that the Supreme Court should read the residency definition in 1391C narrowly in order to discourage forum shopping and the concentration of patent litigation in a few judicial districts. It argues that, quote, policy arguments cannot justify ignoring the statute's plain text, and that resurrecting FORCO would not materially decrease the concentration of patent litigation, but it would rather, quote, merely reshuffle the ranking of the most common forums. Moreover, Kraft points out that such a restrictive definition would create new problems, for example, by requiring patent owners to file duplicative lawsuits if infringers are incorporated in different states. Such changes to the venue rules should come from Congress, Kraft contends, which is better positioned to address the policy concerns and which can adopt more tailored reforms. Kraft argues that Heartland's approach to the venue rules is out of sync with modern venue principles, since Congress has repeatedly expanded the definition of corporate residence to bring the venue laws in tune with modern concepts of corporate operations. Since the Federal Circuit's rule about patent venue is the same rule that applies generally in non-patent cases, Kraft rhetorically asks, quote, why the loud protests about forum shopping here? If anything, Kraft suggests that the real problem may be the Federal Circuit's approach to personal jurisdiction, which upholds specific jurisdiction when infringing products are shipped into a forum through established distribution chains under the so-called stream of commerce theory. Though Heartland also complained in the courts below about this theory of personal jurisdiction, Kraft notes that Heartland chose not to petition on it here. Lastly, Kraft points out that none of the current legislative proposals for amending the venue rules are as restrictive as the Supreme Court's rule in FORCO, and it notes that these proposals are carefully calibrated to eliminate forum shopping by non-practicing entities without dramatically restricting venue choices to other types of plaintiffs. Kraft concludes that while current patent venue system may be imperfect, Heartland's proposed cure is worse than the disease. The case itself has drawn much attention because its outcome will determine where all patent owners, including patent trolls, may sue for infringement. More than 24 amicus briefs have been filed in the Supreme Court at the merit stage, with Heartland receiving a few more in support than Kraft. Despite the case ostensibly turning on the pure issue of statutory construction, the bulk of the amicus briefs make policy arguments. Many of the briefs focus heavily on the practice of forum shopping, where patent owners choose to sue in the forum they think will give them the best chance of success. Much attention is given to one particular forum, the Eastern District of Texas, where many non-practicing entities, or NPEs, bring infringement suits. Heartland supporters see this as a chance to shut the trolls out of Texas. Kraft supporters, on the other hand, argue that the Supreme Court is the wrong branch of government to rewrite the patent venue rules. I'll turn it back over to Dean.
Terrific. Thank you so much. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Once again, if you have a question for our expert today, Professor J. Devlin Heartline, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. A quick commercial announcement, our next scheduled teleforum conference call Wednesday at noon, another discussion of a courthouse steps case, St. Peter's Healthcare System versus Kaplan. That's a religious liberties case. The question there essentially boils down to whether an exemption from ERISA for churches extends or should extend to nonprofit hospitals and schools. Today, if you weren't with us from the outset, we are discussing the T.C. Heartland versus Kraft Foods case. Our expert was not in the courtroom for the oral argument. We plan to review the transcript in anticipation of this call, but the transcript hasn't been released yet. So we're sort of basing this call on the facts of the case, what happened in the lower courts, and the briefs for this case. If you've got a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We'll start with one question. Let's take our first call.
Hi, I represent a lot of individual clients, and mostly small inventors who are pejoratively called trolls don't have the resources to make what they have invented, and they have to wait for some corporation to come along and put the money into setting up manufacturing facilities and marketing. And so they are hugely disadvantaged by anything that that makes it harder for an individual to sue. And so I just dislike the idea that they're called trolls because it's a pejorative they don't deserve. Not exactly a question, but a comment.
Yeah, Professor, do you want to respond to that? I mean, that the lexicon here is sort of does put one party at a disadvantage. It's a pretty strong pejorative. Your thoughts?
Absolutely, and when I use the word trolls, I usually put it in quotes or I preface it with so-called. It's a pejorative term and it's meaningless because there are lots of different business models out there, and not all of them do the supposedly bad things that the trolls do, but they tend to get lumped together into this meaningless term, patent trolls. And for example, the caller mentions that a lot of companies that are smaller, they might be good at inventing things, but they're not good at marketing them. So they'll license their inventions to somebody else. Well, some people would say that they're trolls because they don't produce the things themselves, which I think is fairly nonsensical because it actually makes more sense to let people do what they're good at. And if people are good at inventing, they should invent. And if people are good at marketing and producing, they should do that. And there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, that's the way it's been done since the beginning of the nation.
And I guess the more neutral or benign term is non-practicing entities, those folks who invent things but don't develop them themselves, rather they license them.
Right, yeah, and that's supposedly a more neutral term, but I guess it's better than trolls. I'll give you that.
It sounds like is even that becoming a loaded term, non-practicing entities? That's becoming a pejorative? Or?
I think so. I think so. It's just code for patent trolls when people don't want to say trolls. Yeah, but again, it suffers from the same problem of it actually describes the conduct of universities, but it also describes the conduct of, a subset of NPEs would be the PAEs, the patent assertion entities. And those are the ones that typically will assert the patents against alleged infringers.
Of course, they serve an economic function as well, because the small inventor doesn't have the resources to assert his invention. And so absent those guys, the inventor wouldn't make no money, and the infringers could practice with impunity.
Oh, absolutely. They serve a function, people condemn them, but they don't really have any data to back it up. And it's unfortunate.
There is some data that backs up that sort of thing. Back in the days when helicopters were new inventions, the military had a practice of saying that all you airframe manufacturers who work for us must cross-license anything that is a successful invention. And so the inventors, which mostly were airframe manufacturers, said, "Well, if we take a license under your patent and we put it into our products and it succeeds, then we must cross-license all our competitors. And therefore, we would rather wait till a competitor tries it out and sees if it succeeds, and then we'll take the compulsory cross-license." And so as a result, nobody was taking licenses, and the advance of helicopter technology was slowed by the fact that nobody wanted to be the first on the technological firing line.
Well, that's very interesting. I was referring more to the lack of data condemning so-called patent trolls overall, which lumps together various actors in the innovative ecosystem. And a lot of the people who are supporting Heartland's position in this case are really worried about the concentration of cases in the Eastern District of Texas. And a lot of them will claim, sort of without proof to back it up, that this is a really terrible, quote, tax on innovation. And as your story indicates, that it remains to be seen really what the net effect is of these types of organizations. And the concentration of cases in the Eastern District of Texas is a relatively modern phenomenon. And a lot of people point to the numbers in 2015, where I think it was 44% of all patent cases were filed there, but more recent data shows that the numbers were down significantly in 2016. And since the beginning of 2017, the numbers continue to drop. If you look back a little bit further, go back a few decades, you'll see that patent cases have historically concentrated in certain districts. For example, the
Massachusetts courts, which the appeals court always thought that everything was obvious up there. And that's one of the reasons
exactly.
The Federal Circuit was founded, because all infringers, as soon as the patent issued, the telephones would heat up and the patentee would file in Florida and the infringer would file in Massachusetts, and there'd be this race. The first part of the litigation was to see who had won the race to file the lawsuit first. And
exactly.
with the Federal Circuit there would be a unified standard of review, and you wouldn't get this race to the courthouse, at least because the appeals court would not be different in any patent case.
Right, and that was one of the thoughts behind establishing the Federal Circuit, is we want judges who specialize in patent law. And now that patentees are finding venues that they prefer, ones where the judges specialize in patent law, that's seen as a bad thing. Of course, the reason it's seen as a bad thing, particularly in the Eastern District of Texas, in my opinion, is because that district is seen as being pro-patentee based on the procedural rules that it has and some other factors. And there's probably something to that, given the fact that a lot of plaintiffs are filing there. But the question in my mind is, why is that necessarily a bad thing? You could also say that they're filing there because that's the only district where they're getting a fair shake. And considering all the huge amounts of infringement that are happening, most of it going unlitigated, I think there's some plausibility to that argument.
Well, if you're really big financially, like if you're a Federal Reserve Bank, you can have the statute changed so that it's very hard to sue you for any financial patents.
Yeah.
As they did.
Yeah. Oh, exactly. Exactly. Well, and that's the thing is, you know, a lot of small-time inventors, they just can't outspend the big corporations. And yet it's the big corporations who are complaining about being dragged into Texas.
Yes.
We do have another question pending. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's move on. And if that first caller has another question, you can certainly ring back in by pushing the star button and then the pound button. Go right ahead, caller.
Good afternoon. I have a couple questions, completely unrelated. But first of all, is there any chance that the Supreme Court can kick this back on some procedural issue, especially with the strict rules of mandamus? And then the second question is, does any opinion on 1391C, is there another substantive form statute that 1391C interacts with that might also be kind of indirectly affected by this case?
Great questions. So to your first question about them kicking it back on the procedural issue, it is kind of a weird procedural posture, and I don't know that I've ever seen one exactly like this, but I don't see why that would preclude the Supreme Court from deciding the merits, and it doesn't seem likely that they granted cert in the case just to kick it back to the Federal Circuit on a procedural issue. So I get the sense that they actually want to look at this on the merits and decide whether the Federal Circuit went off the rails in 1990 when it decided that Forco, which had been the law, and there Stoneite before that, and there are a few other cases, where they basically, as an inferior court, declared that the Supreme Court's holdings were no longer good law because 1391C had been changed by Congress. And what's interesting is, if you look at the legislative history of 1988, which the parties dispute some in their brief, but generally speaking, there wasn't an explicit statement from Congress that, hey, we're changing this and we know about Forco and we're overruling Forco. There weren't these direct statements in the legislative history about it. So there is something to Heartland's argument that maybe that's not what the Supreme Court what the Congress was trying to do. To your second question, I'm trying to think of an example. So I know that if you read the briefs of the parties, they do mention how 1391C interacts with statutes, special venue statutes, other than the patent one. And off the top of my head, I'm not remembering one. But it generally speaking, if you look at the changes, especially the ones that were made in 2011, I do think there's something to Kraft's argument that Congress didn't want to go through the U.S. codes and try and find every specific venue statute and then rewrite it so it worked perfectly with 1391C. The easier fix was just to change 1391C and then maybe some other statutes would read a little bit weird. It might, in fact, make parts of the other statutes surplusage as compared to certain defendants. But honestly, trying to sit down and figure that out would be an overwhelming task. And it makes sense that Congress meant what it said in 2011, that the that the definitions in 1391C apply to all venue actions in the federal district courts. And it's, for me personally, it's hard to read that and to think that it doesn't apply to 1400B. And the best arguments for why it wouldn't are historical. And you look at Forco and Stonite and other cases going back to 1897, it was just that the patent statute was alone and it wasn't to be read, that the general statute wasn't to be read into it. On the other hand, in 2011, when Congress revamped 1391C, it obviously knew about VE holding and it knew how these statutes were being interpreted, and it didn't do anything to change them. In fact, as mentioned in the briefs, the American Law Institute recommended that 1400B just be excised from the U.S. Code altogether. And interestingly, Congress did not do that. It kept it. It also kept 1400A, which is a similar statute for copyright cases. But it did change 1391C to make it very broad, knowing full well that under VE holding, which most consider to be the law of the land on this issue, that it would be read into 1400B. So I don't have an exact answer on other statutes affected by 1391C, but hopefully that helps.
Yes, thank you. And did anyone argue that there was some sort of implicit repeal of 1400B?
Implicit repeal?
Of 1400B, that it's little use in light of the revised 2011 1391C.
Well, 1400B, both parties agree that 1400B is the sole and exclusive venue statute in a patent case, right? So you're not establishing venue under 1391C. And so what's interesting is both sides agree that at least that part of Forco is still the law. 1400B is the venue statute for a patent case. Where they disagree is whether it's the definition of resides in 1391C applies to 1400B, and that's what this case is about.
Understood.
Well, our lines are wide open. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've still got some time left. While we're waiting to see if somebody else dials in, Professor, you mentioned a great number of amicus briefs in this case at various stages. I think you told me there were three different briefs by academics, by scholars at the Supreme Court level, a total of 98 professors. What if you want to go into a little more detail about what they were arguing, what side they were on, and what they had to say?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So there were three amicus briefs at the merit stage that were filed by professors of law and other professors. And it's interesting to see how they lined up. So the first brief was 61 professors of law and economics, and this was organized by Mark Limley at Stanford. And that brief backed Heartland, and they argued, well, they began the brief arguing about the text of the statute. They said that VE holding was wrong and Forco was right. And they called the 1988 amendments to 1391C, quote, a ministerial change, trying to downplay the significance. And they echoed Heartland's argument about how Congress does not hide elephants in mouse holes. And they argued, too, that if you read 1400B the way that Kraft says, it renders the second half of it largely superfluous. Now, they say largely superfluous because they acknowledge that it's only superfluous as to corporate defendants, but for an individual defendant, it actually still applies. So it's not completely superfluous. So the superfluity argument isn't 100% on point because there are still some people who would fall under the second half of 1400B. But the bulk of their brief actually focused on policy issues. And they argue that the Federal Circuit's permissive venue rules has, quote, harmed the patent system in three distinct ways. So they're all interrelated. They argue that it led to forum shopping and forum selling. Now, forum selling is interesting because the argument there is that the courts themselves will tailor their rules in order to attract litigants. And they argue that the court in the Eastern District of Texas has done exactly this. Second, they argue that the broad venue rules have contributed to the growth of opportunistic patent litigation by patent trolls who take advantage of the leverage that these rules and procedures make possible. So you've got the courts selling their forum. You've got the patent trolls latching on to the procedural rules that benefit them. And then they note that, as far as case concentration goes, it's led to 44% of all patent cases being filed in the Eastern District of Texas in 2015, which they claim is a problem for the legal system, whatever you think of that district. As I noted earlier, the numbers have been down if you look at the 2016 numbers or the 2017 numbers to date. But their main concern is forum shopping and case concentration. There was a brief filed on Kraft's side. There was actually two briefs filed by professors. The first was a group of 15 professors who teach patent law and civil procedure. That brief was organized by Megan LaBelle at Catholic University. And they actually argue that the Federal Circuit's interpretation of the venue statute is completely consistent with the statute's plain language and with the broader historical trends in venue law. So they echo Kraft's argument that FORCO is no longer good law because 1391C is markedly different. And they note that at the time FORCO was decided, so this is back in 1957, applying the version of Section 1391C that was passed in 1948. Well, at the time, the two provisions were substantive, and they potentially govern venue and patent cases. So you could look to 1391C, or you could look to 1400B, and each one could potentially establish venue. And they said that those two statutes were inconsistent. So it was easy to understand why the Supreme Court in FORCO said that the narrower, more specific statute, 1400B, was the sole provision controlling venue and patent infringement actions. And they said with the 1988 amendments, the big difference was that 1391C is no longer a substantive provision. It doesn't establish jurisdiction. It is purely definitional. And as a consequence, we can now read 1391C and 1400B in perfect harmony. And they suggest that the 2011 amendments only bolster this conclusion. As far as the venue rules in other types of federal litigation, these professors argue that there's no reason to believe that Congress intended to protect corporate defendants in patent cases more than in other types of civil cases. So the rule of the Federal Circuit, going back to BE Holding, is actually the same rule that we apply to corporations in other federal litigation. And so they say that rather than create a different rule for patent cases, the Federal Circuit law treats corporate defendants in patent cases just like corporate defendants in any other federal civil action. And finally, to the concern about the concentration of cases in the Eastern District of Texas, these professors argue that there are better avenues to address reform, such as by Congress. And then finally, there is a second brief supporting Kraft that was filed by a group of 22 professors of law, economics, and business. This was led by Ted Sickleman of the University of San Diego, and I was one of the 22 signatories to this amicus brief. These professors argue that the Federal Circuit's venue rules actually better serve the aims of patent law, and there's three reasons for this. First, they note that reversing the Federal Circuit here would not actually meaningfully change the concentration of patent cases. And they point to a recent study that concluded that with Heartland winning this case, roughly 60% of cases will continue to be filed in the same handful of jurisdictions, with the Northern District of California and the District of Delaware increasing the most, that is getting the most cases. They argue that there's no plausible argument that can be made that shifting from one district, the Eastern District of Texas, to two districts, Northern District of California and the District of Delaware, would result in a meaningful distribution of patent cases among the 94 federal district courts. Second, these professors note that those who complain that the Eastern District of Texas is, quote, too pro-patentee, fail to acknowledge that the Northern District of California and the District of Delaware, where many cases would move to, are less hospitable to patent owners. And they argue that it is unsurprising that a large corporate defendants would often find themselves accused of patent infringement would undertake efforts to relocate their cases to jurisdictions in which they are more likely to obtain favorable results. And they note that Heartland supporters have been lobbying Congress to change the venue rules for years. They contend that Heartland's position would merely tilt the playing field against patentees, which does not actually promote the goal of equitable case distribution. And finally, the professors argue that Congress has already determined that corporate defendants are generally subject in any civil complaint to venue in any district in which personal jurisdiction lies. And they note that this is no different from other areas of law when it comes to forum shopping, because plaintiffs in general will choose the forum that provides it the best opportunity of success. And as to the contention that non-practicing entities, our so-called patent trolls, are generally bring weak cases, the professors argue that there is no valid empirical evidence supporting this assertion. And moreover, they argue that the assertion that the venue rules applying to all patent owners should be severely restricted given the actions of some patent owners, the so-called patent trolls, is not only ill-advised, but it's fundamentally unfair to those patent owners who file good faith claims. So that's the three briefs that were filed by the professors, which interestingly garnered a total of 98 signatures, although I think there were two professors who signed two briefs, so maybe it's closer to 96.
Interesting. Once again, if you're in the audience, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open. While we're waiting to see if anybody else rings in. You've mentioned, Professor, a couple times it's a statutory interpretation case. Is that likely the basis the court's going to decide this case on? Just look at the plain language of the statute? Conversely said that a lot of the briefs are sort of headed in a policy direction, which might be at odds with the statutory language.
Exactly. And in my sense, reading the briefs, was that they would go through the motions of the statutory argument just so they could get to the policy argument, which is why everybody's so interested in this case. I think very few people care whether Kraft Foods sues TC Heartland in Delaware or Indiana. I mean, obviously Heartland cares a lot, but that's not why people care about this case. People care about this case because they're worried about the Eastern District of Texas and the broader ramifications of the Supreme Court's holding. So it is ostensibly a case about just reading the statutes, right? Like, do we read 1391 into 1400? But it's naive to think that that's the only thing that matters. And without having heard the oral argument, I imagine that at some point the policy concerns were discussed, probably in detail.
Yeah. Let me ask a final question. I don't see another question from the audience. This is sort of veers away from this particular case, but touches on it in a way. The Federal Circuit was put in there for reasons that you've mentioned. One consequence, though, that must have been foreseen, although maybe there wasn't a lot of weight given to it, was the idea that with all these cases coming up through one circuit, you're not going to get circuit splits. You're not going to get cases that sort of percolate with the benefit of, two or three circuits thinking about a case this way and three or four other circuits thinking in the other direction, and sort of all that jurisprudence leading up to the Supreme Court, which allows the Supreme Court the benefit of those arguments having been maybe more thoroughly developed. How do you perceive that? Is the Federal Circuit on the whole, with concentrated expertise in IP cases, a great idea, a good idea? What are your thoughts on that? I'm just curious.
Yeah, well, of course, it is interesting that you don't get circuit splits because, well, especially after the AIA, there used to be the rule that if the complaint stated a patent claim, then it would go to the Federal Circuit. It didn't matter if there was a counterclaim for a patent counterclaim. But now the rule under the AIA is that even if there's a patent counterclaim, we're going to go to the Federal Circuit. So, as you say, we basically have one court that hears all patent appeals from the district courts. And so you see divisions within the federal circuit. They're not all of one mind, and so I think that's a good thing. But then you have the problem, like you mentioned, that we don't get traditional circuit splits. So which is probably why we get cases like this on such an interesting procedural posture. It's a very important legal issue, because where patent owners can sue is a really big deal to patent owners and to defendants alike. But we haven't got other circuits weighing in on these very statutes. And in fact, when the Federal Circuit said that the Supreme Court's older case law was no longer good law in 1990, it's interesting to note that the Supreme Court denied cert in that case. They didn't take it, which you would think, if they were really upset about the Federal Circuit having done that, they might have taken the case. But at least in this case, the issue itself, even though it's a weird posture, it's the only issue in the case. So it's interesting, because Heartland had argued about personal jurisdiction as well in the district court and again at the Federal Circuit. And it's a combination of the Federal Circuit's jurisprudence on personal jurisdiction and venue that has led to the cases being decided in Texas. It's those two things that give the Eastern District of Texas jurisdiction and venue. But they basically dropped their personal jurisdiction arguments and focused solely on the venue arguments. And even though the case started with three patents, it's actually now down to one. And despite the fact that it's going to the Supreme Court, the case below in the district court has actually been ongoing since it was started. But what's interesting too is a lot of times, because there is no circuit split, the Supreme Court will ask the Solicitor General to file a brief to give the view of the United States. So at least that way, even though it's not another appellate court, it gets another opinion that's not the parties, right?
Right.
And in this case, the Supreme Court did not ask the Solicitor General for his views. So, what's interesting here is we don't have the circuit split. We basically have the parties, but at least the issue is cleanly presented, and there's no other issues that would kind of mess it up. It's actually a really good vehicle for this issue. And having read through the briefs, I think both sides have done a phenomenal job coming up with the best arguments that they could possibly come up with. And I do think the Supreme Court will decide this case on the merits.
We've got a couple questions pending now. We've got about 7 minutes left, so let's see if we can get to these final two callers. Go ahead, caller.
Yes, one more comment and then a question. The comment is that the reason the circuit splits were so bad before the advent of the Federal Circuit was because the Supreme Court hated to hear patent cases in those days and didn't want to get into all the technical aspects. And so the circuit splits were allowed to linger, and the Federal Circuit was devised to avoid those circuit splits, since the Supreme Court apparently had no interest in patent cases. And the question is, will there be another one of these once we have the transcript available?
Another telephone conference call? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, there seems to be a lot of interest in this case. And we'll either do one when the transcript's available or certainly when the case is decided. So stay tuned for that. We'll get back to you on that and monitor your emails and the Federal Society website for further information on that. Let's move on to our next caller. Could be the final question of the day here. Go ahead, caller.
Hi, Professor. I appreciate your comments. I wanted to see if you had comments on the fact that the Texas Attorney General joined a brief, an amicus brief, supporting TC Heartland.
Yeah, you know, I saw that and I read the brief and I kind of scratched my head. And I'm wondering, because it wasn't just Texas, it was several states, right? And I don't have any information on what's going on behind the scenes with that brief, but it's definitely noteworthy that the state of Texas has taken Heartland's side.
You know, it would seem to suggest that the state of Texas, at certain bar associations, this has been discussed, and some people conjectured that the state of Texas looks at what the effect is on jobs and business. And to a lot of overseas businesses, the first introduction they have to Texas is when they find out they have been sued in the Eastern District of Texas. And it may simply be that the Texas leadership or certain political segments of Texas have decided that it's in their best interest not to be seen as a judicial hellhole, but rather a place that's good to do business. And it may simply be that or some other basis. But it seemed interesting that part of the state of Texas was taking a position that was adverse to the cottage industry that's been prospering in the Eastern District.
No, that's interesting. I wonder how much we could read into it, though, like given the fact that other states signed on to the brief as well, right? So I'm pulling it up right now. Yes, we've got Arizona, Colorado, Connecticut, Hawaii, Illinois, and like 8 other states signed on to it as well. So it's interesting that Texas is the lead plaintiff, and I'm sure that wasn't an accident to put their name first, given the concerns about the Eastern District of Texas. But yeah, I honestly don't have any idea what was going on behind the scenes. I will comment though that I really think that this case is just a bad vehicle for reforming the venue rules, because the Supreme Court just has a binary choice. You know, it can affirm the Federal Circuit or it can overrule it. It can't carefully craft a rule. And, given recent indications and given past history with efforts such as the Innovation Act or the Venue Act, it seems exceedingly clear that the Supreme Court knows that it can just punt on this case and it can affirm the Federal Circuit and say, hey, we've been doing it this way since 1990. We're not going to overrule it now and upset the last 3 decades of jurisprudence. And then leave it for Congress to decide on how best to deal with this issue. And the advantage of that is Congress can obviously craft something more careful, like, for instance, the Venue Act. Well, I'm not thrilled about it. It's at least way better than overturning the Federal Circuit here.
We are out of questions, Professor. We've got a minute or two left. If you want to, I'll give you a chance to express any final thoughts you might have.
Oh, well, I just wanted to thank you again, Dean, and to the Federalist Society for having me. And I really appreciate the chance to talk about this. And sorry that the transcript hadn't come out yet. I'm looking. Oh, it just posted. So it's available now, which unfortunately it wasn't available before the call. And but I do want to thank all of the people for calling in and listening and for asking questions. And it's a very interesting case, and hopefully we will have an answer, I'm guessing, sometime in June. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Professor. It's a real pleasure to have you on the call with us. And I want to extend my thanks as well to the audience for dialing in and for your thoughtful questions. And a reminder about our next scheduled teleforum call, Wednesday at noon. I suppose we could have one tomorrow on the fly, sort of. But our next scheduled teleforum conference call, Wednesday at noon, another Supreme Court case on religious liberties. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.